We will open the meeting with the reading of a document which sets forth the principles by which the lodge is governed. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order to carry out the policy of this lodge, the Philadelphia Lodge has a program consisting of the following. There are meetings held on Sundays as well as on Wednesdays. Now, each Sunday morning, there is a lecture or a talk or a forum. And this Sunday morning, the title of the lecture is Karma, the Law of Justice and Mercy. Now, these Sunday morning meetings follow a particular theme of the month. And the month of November is Reincarnation and Karma. Next Sunday, there will be a panel entitled Plato's Parable of the Cave. Now, all of these Sunday meetings begin promptly at 11 o'clock and last until 12 noon. And following the meetings is always time for questions and discussion. On Wednesday evenings, there is a study class. The class text chosen is The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. The class has advanced now to the fourth chapter of The Ocean, and the title for this coming Wednesday is The Human Constitution Follows Universal Principles. Now also on Wednesdays there is a library, which is open from 5:30 until 7:30. This library carries a straight line of theosophical literature consisting of books, pamphlets, magazines, comprising the original writings of the founders of the theosophical movement. There are other related texts available which may be of interest, and we suggest if one is interested, contact the librarian. Also on Wednesdays, you will find a reference in the library in connection with the evening's class, as well as on the table in back of the usher. Just outside of this meeting room, you will find this same straight theosophic literature on display. And it may be purchased either during the library hours or before or after our regular meetings. All activities of this lodge are free. The lodge continues to be sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money, and all are most welcome to to participate. The reading for today has been selected from The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, page 643. An occultist, or a philosopher, will not speak of the goodness or cruelty of providence, but identifying it with karma nemesis, he will teach that nevertheless it guards the good and watches over them in this, as in future lives, and that it punishes the evildoer, even to the seventh rebirth. So long, in short, as the effect of his having thrown into perturbation even the smallest atom in the infinite world of harmony has not been finally adjusted, for the only decree of karma, an eternal and immutable decree, is absolute harmony in the world of matter as it is in the world of spirit. It is not therefore karma that rewards or punishes, but it is we who reward or punish ourselves, according to whether we work with, through, and along with nature, abiding by the laws of which that harmony depends, or break them. Nor with the ways of karma be inscrutable, were men to work in union and harmony instead of disunion and strife. For our ignorance of those ways, which one portion of mankind calls the ways of providence, dark and intricate, while another sees in them the action of blind fatalism, and a third, simple chance, with neither gods nor devils to guide them, would surely disappear, if we would but attribute all these to their correct cause. With right knowledge, or at any rate, with a confident conviction that our neighbors will not work more to harm, hurt us, than we would think of hurting them, the two-thirds of the world's evil would vanish into thin air. The subject of the talk for this morning is Karma, the Law of Justice and Mercy.
First and foremost, we would recommend to anyone that does not yet own one of these, you should really own three or four. You should have one in your car, one at your desk at work, one at your nightstand, and one on your in your purse or in your pocket, because these are the most meditative little aphorisms. If you take one a day, at the end of 31 days, because that's how many there are, you will have insight into something that is essentially unknowable. That is in, there's also Mr. Judge's article, Karma, in this pamphlet, and it's going to cost you a whole 25 cents, so buy a bunch. Well, we know what he says is that here it is. Karma is not subject to time, and therefore he who knows what is the ultimate division of time in this universe knows karma. For all other men, karma is, in its essential nature, unknown and unknowable. But its action may be known by calculation from cause to effect. And this calculation is possible because the effect is wrapped up in and is not succedent to the cause. We know that, friends. We live by that realization. Whether it's walking, talking, moving your hand, anything and everything we do, whether we do it well or poorly, is all on the basis of cause and effect, action and reaction. And we know it's an endless cycle. A cause brings an effect, which creates a new cause, which brings an effect. Where we fall down with this realization is we see it and apply it and understand it physically. And that's as far as we go. That's as far as science goes. And yet, at the same time, with all of that activity to do something, we know very well where it started. It did not start in the physical. If you want to move your hand, first there's a thought, and then a will which fires something in your body which causes that action. Everything you do, you begin in the mind, in thought. So it is with the universe. We found so many wonderful things to read that we felt reading them to you would be kinder than trying to express them. We think this is one of the best descriptions of karma. A law of nature is not a command, but a statement of conditions. This cannot be repeated too often. Nature does not order this thing or the other. She says, here are certain conditions. Where these exist, such and such a result will invariably follow. If you do not like the result, change the preceding conditions. Apply that to yourself. Anything you don't like in your life, in your circumstances, in your temperament, in your appetites, in your skills, change the conditions, and that will change them. Ignorant, you are helpless at the mercy of nature's hurtling forces. Wise, you are master, and her forces serve you obediently. Every law of nature is an enabling, not a compelling force, but knowledge is necessary to use her powers. Nature lays down the conditions which result in the production of water, and you cannot change them. She neither supplies nor withholds water. You're free to have it or to go without it. If you want it, you must bring together the necessary things and make the conditions. Without these, no water. Are you bound or free? Free as to making the conditions, bound as to the result when once you have made them. And that is the other place where we fall down so helplessly. How did this terrible thing happen to me? You know, to answer such a question, we have to really encompass the entire philosophy. The realization that we are spiritual beings, enduring thinkers that incarnate life after life only because of this great law of karma. Although it is said that initially our escapades, if we can call them that, here on earth, began because of our spiritual nature and our desire to elevate life, to bring the best of ourselves to it. Unfortunately, once we got wrapped up in it, we enjoyed it more than the duties that we have in front of us. So we have created these conditions, but that doesn't harm us in any way because it's the law of justice and mercy. Now, for so many people, justice means an eye for an eye, revenge. But philosophically, it means the equal result of what has been done. It's an unerring law of balance. Without the personal prejudice that we might bring into it, it is just because it is perfect. But then, how is it merciful? People tend to think of mercy as you get away with something. Somebody somebody takes away the problem or the punishment. They do a merciful thing for you. You're forgiven. You're allowed to escape. Theosophy says that's not mercy. That just leaves you as badly off as you always were. It's that little parable that if you had a master to walk you through your problem, at the end, you wouldn't have that problem, but you'd still have you. And how would you face the next problem? You wouldn't have learned anything. You have to go through things in order to develop the skills and the muscles to handle the next challenge. It isn't merciful to be released from your problems. True mercy is what, obviously, karma does. Look, we're here, this whole humanity. We seem to be a very big mess, but we don't see karma stopping us. We see the opposite, opportunities. That is mercy. Over and over again, the struggle of life to make us understand what we have to fix, what we have to do. And it's usually only after we have suffered a great deal when we sit down and say, what am I doing wrong? Why is this happening? And that's when we begin the mercy with ourselves. Mr. Judge wrote an article, Is Karma Merciful? It is true that karma is just. It isn't an article, it's an answer to a question. Because it exacts payment to the last farthing. But on the other hand, it is eternally merciful, since it unerringly pays out its compensations. It is only through pain that the soul acquires the precise knowledge and strength it requires. If you didn't get the result of your actions, how would you learn whether that action was wise or ignorant? Now, Nemesis was mentioned in the reading from the Secret Doctrine, but in a footnote on that same page, HPB writes, with the early Greeks, Nemesis was no goddess, but a moral feeling, the barrier to evil and immorality. He who transgresses that moral feeling commits a sacrilege in the eyes of the gods and is pursued by Nemesis. If we would connect karma with Nemesis, it has to be done in the triple character of the latter, Nemesis, Andrestia, and Themis. Themis is the goddess of universal order and harmony and keeps man within the limits of nature. Adrastia represents Nemesis as the immutable effect of causes created by man himself. And if you look through other mythologies, you will find the Fates and the Norns. The interesting thing is that they all relate to the spinning of a thread. And that thread is then severed at the end of the life by one of the Norns. An interesting analogy about karma, one of the masters wrote, it's like a tapestry, and you may have the opportunity to see that tapestry you've been making, and you may see some threads that are dark and pulled out of shape, but it does not change the overall picture. The overall picture is a soul in evolution, working through the very problems that they have created for themselves. We'll close with this from Theosophical Movement magazine. And anyone who is really interested in, the challenge of seeing yourself through your own higher vision should definitely look at Theosophical Movement magazine. It's very uplifting. Each soul, a attracts to itself its natural conditions. There are no misfits. All are attracted to a particular environment according to karma, their past deeds, words, feelings, and thoughts, so that they may learn through them and grow in purity, making also the environment pure, and so that the very devil in them may be raised to the stage of divinity. We're sure you have questions. We have lots. Yes.
Is there a time limit for an individual to learn a certain situation, a certain lesson? I mean, some people have to go over the same thing over and over and over again.
Aren't you just answering your question? Isn't that exactly what happens? Isn't that what nature does? Over and over again. You may have to repeat the same stupidity for several lives. That's also covered in here. Three lives at least if you don't take some steps to understand and repair. So, no, there is no time limit. We are told that in the future, and this is a long ways off, we don't have to be nervous about it, we should think about it, that there will come a time when a choice must be made, when you put down all these childish things and begin the serious work of development, not for your sake, but for the sake of humanity and for all life. At that point, those who have not developed the powers and the strengths, that's the mental power, the heart power, the ability to go on, will drop out, just like you have to drop out of college sometimes. And then they, those thinkers, will rest and sleep oblivious until the next earth begins, and they will have that karma of what they accomplished as well as what they failed to accomplish to begin from that point. Yes?
Well, in that example, time is really the key. What position we take now on little teeny weeny decisions about doing better or best or just good enough, those little tiny decisions in the now bloom, don't they, across time.
Again, we're right back into what we know. You put a seed in the ground, you provide the proper care, and it blooms. Yes.
So in a given cycle, maybe in a given life cycle, if one is taught as a child to really not do good enough or try better, but puts forth that best and lives a life along those lines, how confident can he be that from there on in it's clear sailing?
The only way there's clear sailing is if you're guaranteed A, water, and B, a boat. Clear sailing.
Wind.
Oh, yes, but you can also paddle, that's true. There's difficulties in answering this question because if there's anything students of theosophy, students of the masters of wisdom don't want, it's clear sailing. Because you will not develop any muscles if you've got the wind at your back and you just keep going. You need tasks, you need difficulties. So the one who is raised to do his or her best and does it has a wonderful strength. And if their heart is into this wisdom, they will get bigger difficulties than most people. They can count on that. Because clear sailing is not the task. Yes.
Well, clear sailing is part of karma too. To a point, it's a respite. But while you're doing the clear sailing, you need to be looking at the horizon. If you're clear sailing and your hand is in the water and you're just gazing at the sky and you know, there could be a storm or even a rogue wave coming. So it's good. I mean, it's good, but we should be, they're the times we should really be more alert and try to sharpen our senses, not to be passive. Because if we're passive during states of clear sailing, we're going to get hit.
And we don't learn anything. Make hay while the sun shines is a very good saying. Yes.
Well, perhaps to restate the question, previous question, another way. If one lives each moment of their life, each day, to the best of their ability,
mm-hmm.
in any future condition imaginable, storm or not, will not their vision be clear of what they need to do under the circumstances?
Yes and no. We have to remember we're not a straight line. The karma of this life is not everything that's going to unfold in the next life. We're more like a formula of all these things brought together. Again, this is invaluable for that because it points out that we have karma acting in different areas of our life. We have different fields of karma, and we might have one thing going beautifully and some other aspect falling apart. Now, in the case of someone who has, and we've always loved this expression, gone for good, better, best, never let it rest, till your good be better and your better be best. The one who is sincerely doing their best will probably have clues to the problems that confront them. It doesn't mean they'll be problemless. It means they'll be more acutely aware, perhaps. Yes?
We're thinking that, yes, they may be more acutely aware and know what to do, but there could be karmic conditions from the past,
yes,
which will obscure that accumulated character. It's said we don't realize in our everyday lives the greatness of our character because
mm-hmm.
of the karmic obstacles.
Right, and because we've built these brick walls in front of us, not glass, they're brick. We always remind ourselves, Pythagoras was murdered. Martin Luther King was murdered. I mean, think about those souls that have lived giving their best and doing everything they could only to be struck down. And that murder did not happen because of that life per se. It is said that there are those who have developed to the point they could walk through a jungle, the world's most vicious animals. Nothing will come near them or threaten them. You had your hand up.
We live in a universe that is governed by time. We don't know anything but time. We have past, present, future. So we're thinking about, okay, like the question, is there a time limit to achieve something? In this life, we don't know anything else. But there's indication that in the bigger universe, there is no time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we recall...
Everything is at the same time.
Well, we recall a student here who answered that question, oh, really? What time is it now? It's now. What time is it now? It's now. It is always now. For our convenience, we go now from the past, now for the future. It isn't. It is always now. The thinker is always present with a body, without a body, and it's always now. We have to get some grasp of that to realize with our little finite minds and our senses, we contract everything down to a time thing. We have all the time in the universe, and yet we shouldn't slow down. It's only now. Now. Yes?
Which feeds into his comment about doing the best you can at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes.
Do the right thing at this time.
Yes, do it now, because it's in front of you now. Now, that is one of the basic teachings of theosophy. If you can't do any more than your duty, you have done enough. Do it now, do it well, and do it without any hope for what it's going to gain for you. That's acting like a soul in evolution. Do it now. Yes?
Several times the idea was presented that if you want to change the karmic effect, change the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can we look at that without assuming that the way to change conditions is just leave?
Yes, and that's often what people do, but there's a phrase that covers that in popular thinking, and that's wherever you go, you have to take yourself. And the condition you have to change is yourself, not the conditions outside of you. We're giant magnets, every one of us, and we attract the people, the reading material, the everything in our lives. We pull to us what we make of it and do with it. That is a choice. That's all we have, is a choice. But the conditions we have to change are internal. It's our heart, our motive, our desires, the way we think and feel and respond to life. Those are the conditions. Yes?
We've often heard in this room the term skill and the right performance of action. Mm-hmm. Are there any guidelines for developing those skills?
Skill, that's really the definition of yoga, skill in the performance of action. How do we go about developing such skills? What do you think? I know the Carnegie Hall joke. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Yes.
Could we restate the question we missed?
Well, the question is, in skill in the performance of action, are there any guidelines that theosophy gives us to develop those skills? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Spot where you're awake and you do know that you're creating the conditions, but you don't know exactly what you need to do to make those changes, and it can be terrible to be in the middle of being aware of that, but also still being stuck.
Right, that's excellent. But then how does one move from there? If you are in the position of being aware that there are things within you and without you that need to be fixed, in one sense, you are in paradise.
I just think that that's when sometimes intention doesn't feel like enough, because you feel like you do have those intentions for the highest good, but something's not working.
You could never solve the problem, fix the problem, until you saw it. And you are in a position as a perceiver looking at the problem. One of the things we're taught is not to run away from something we see in ourselves, but to examine it, to be a scientist with it, to study it. We know what our intention is. To get intention to problem is not easy, but we have to understand what the problem is. And then we have to go through the world's most embarrassing thing, where we have to go out and watch ourselves in action, using that tendency that we have, until it embarrasses us so much, and we don't understand why the world isn't laughing at us, because we're so childish and petty. And then we begin to see we can control it. So it's a process of perception, investigation, experimentation, and then control. You had your hand up?
Yes. What I struggle with, and I mentioned this before, is some people, for instance, have depression. or mental illnesses, maybe not that severe, but they may be aware that they have it, but they, it's very difficult for them to change. So, or some kind of behavioral issues. So how does this philosophy, again, take into consideration?
First of all, such an individual with mental or emotional or even physical handicaps is reaping the result of a previous karma. We may not see that as good or merciful, but it is, because it's being removed. When they finish that life, if they haven't reactivated all the things that started it up, it's finished. It's done. So it is a blessing in disguise. We don't see that. An individual may live through a life like that and not make one inch in any direction. What we fail to see is the soul is awake and learning from the experience. Now, sometimes the learning is bitterness, and that soul may come into incarnation full of anger. But usually what it is the soul has, we don't know how to express this. It isn't an epiphany, but the soul will have moments when it will touch clarity and can actually bring it through that instrument. We used to work with retarded adults, and oftentimes they would say something that would absolutely stun you. They could see themselves objectively and could see how different they were, but they could accept that it was all right. It was the way they were. So we think, there's a wonderful book. It's old. It's called If a Man Be Mad. And it was a brilliant thinker who was in a mental asylum, and he couldn't understand how he got there. And he suddenly realized his whole problem was selfishness, that all he ever thought about was himself. And so he started reaching out to patients and trying to help them, and discovered he had a great facility for it, and ended up working in the mental health field. And he wrote this book, If a Man Be Mad, that there is that thinker, no matter what the condition, is always present and always aware. Yes?
I think one of the challenges with being aware of conditions and wanting to change them with the right intention is that we not only want to get the right causes, but we're determined to establish the right effects too.
Oh, definitely.
We want things
to work out like we want.
And that's where the tension
comes
in. Yes. Well, so that's why karma is merciful. Once we set up the cause, we just need let it go and let it go to the law of cause and effect. It will take care of the results because they lie inherently in the actions we set up.
Yes, one of the things we often try to do is fight the entire will of the universe. And all we have to do is create the right condition, set up the right cause, and then drop back. Put your attention on something else, because the result will come, and you will learn from it. If it isn't enough, you can learn to do a little more. The other problem is we're Westerners, and we have over-dramatized our individuality, our ability to get everything done when we want it done, to multitask, which means we don't bring our best to any of the tasks we're doing. We recently mailed a package to a friend in California, and she recently sent back my mail, which was included in the package. We hurry to do things. We rush because someone's going to the post office, and we pick up something, and it's very bad. We think as a society, as a civilization, we're not paying attention the way we should. And that is one of the processes that's given to us by theosophy. When you awaken in the morning, perceive that you are a thinker. I am not this body. I'm not these conditions. I'm not this personality. I'm a soul in evolution. And what I'm going to face today, I created using my own powers. And we can maybe think out the day and how we would wish to act in certain difficulties. At the end of the day, a review. It's exactly what life is going to do for us at the end of this life. We look at what came to us, how we responded, but not in a hypercritical way, but to see what are the tendencies, what are the conditions, what can I begin to work on. It's very exciting if you think about it. You become the most exciting kind of detective and scientist. And it's something that you fashioned with great difficulty. None of us have any idea how some characteristic about us that we don't even like, how much it cost us to develop it. It might have been a protective measure in some difficult life, and we hang on to it because we think it's me, but it's not. It's my mask. It's what I'm hiding behind. So it's very exciting when you think about it. Yes. Wait one second. Yes, sir.
What I hear here is, in a way, a kind of division where what we're speaking about here is what we apply as we observe ourselves throughout the day on a fairly deep level as we look at it. And on the other hand, I see, you might say, the ethics of behavior interacting with people. And that often takes over, I find. And we're steeped in it. And we're trying at the same time to keep these two together.
But and I don't understand. How can ethics be separated from what we're trying to do?
In the interaction you give and take with people, you say certain things, and little by little it can happen that you're not observing yourself. You're right with that person. You're interacting with him or her, and it seems difficult. Maybe in that very moment one can be an observer.
Difficult for most of us. But what can you do after that interaction?
Oh, after it, but not during it.
But no, you're working towards that point. We all are. To be able to be in control, no matter what. And say you're in an argument with someone. You can be debating a point and yet inside be completely calm and detached from whether or not the person is getting anything from what you say.
I'm not there.
Well,
I mean,
no,
I
we
just
said you can be. But the point is that if you know you're not there, that means you are observing yourself. And you're observing what isn't happening. So you're still the observer. It's just to bring the two, the ideal, into the moment. It's not easy. Of course it's not easy. 18 million years we've been building up these characteristics, these tendencies. Why should it be easy to just fix it? Yes?
Sometimes keeping a journal and glancing back at the journal helps, because it's true, if we're lost in the moment, we're measuring things with an elastic band. We're flexible, we're reacting. Whereas if we step back a little bit and we think about where were we 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 months ago, then we begin to measure with a firm, standard, golden rule of a measure.
That's called the Hindu Chela's diary. Keep a diary of those things. You know, it's just like with small children. If you have a small child in your house, you haven't really noticed until someone who hasn't seen that child for several months comes over and goes, oh my, how that child has grown. It's the same way with yourself. You don't know or see the qualities and things you have improved, but you don't have to. They're there. and they become the basis for the next step. So you already are observing. You just need to take some time after an event to see what could I have done to keep me from sliding down that hill that I moved down so quickly into that mood or feeling. Yes?
Well, it's not so much that it's we can't be the observer and engaged in interaction at the same time. The problem is we can't be both personal and impersonal.
That's true.
You can't think of yourself with one of all life and separate from all life. And that's what we do.
Yes.
We meditate on these ideas, we get a sensation of the oneness of life, and then we put all that aside, and now we begin interacting as those we were separate
right.
personalities. Well, as long as we do that, we can't bring the two together. One of them has to go.
There's a wonderful realization, if you have ever used that expression. He or she certainly knows how to push my buttons. We know what that means, that that person can trigger reactions and actions in us. But we're missing the most important part of that statement. They're my buttons. If they're my buttons, why should you have the right to do anything with them? The problem is me and my buttons. Not you and the fact that you're able to do that. Once we learn that, once we see that, we're in a different position. We have an Epictetus quote that we think is one of the most invaluable things you could ever be given. If you hear that someone is speaking ill of you, instead of trying to defend yourself, you should say, he obviously does not know me very well, since there are so many other faults he could have mentioned. Epictetus. And this from Elbert Hubbard. We don't know if any of you have ever read the notebooks of Elbert Hubbard. We awaken in others the same attitude of mind we hold towards them. These are powerful thoughts. And if we would stabilize ourselves by realizing I always have a choice, they're my buttons, my conditions, I am in charge, whether I act like it or not. Yes.
It's also true that we are all interrelated, and some of the anxiety that happens is over worrying about karma to come, whether it's the end of the Mayan calendar, whether it's is there going to be any money to be more than a bag person at the end of life, you know, all those issues. We're part of the collective. It is a reality, this angst.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we work within that?
How do we work within that reality? We've always thought Mr. Crosby's solution to such a problem was a brilliant way to go. You sit yourself down and you say, okay, I have lost everything. I have no job, I have no money, I have no home, I have no family, I have no friends. And you just keep it up and you keep honestly thinking about it. And you realize, well, the only thing I have is I. And that was all I ever had to begin with. Well, okay then, I'm not afraid. Because at the end of all of it, I remain. We have to realize that poverty is not a punishment, that it may very well be that a strong soul took it on to understand it, to experience it, and to help others in that condition. None of these things are punishments or problems. They're instructors. Yes?
The first part of what you're saying reminded me, there's an Indian, I guess a mantra, which says, speaking to this indwelling self, thou art my compassionate father, thou art my loving mother, thou art my true friend and constant companion, thou art my only treasure, thou art all, in all. Mm-hmm. When everything else mm-hmm. is left, this
that's
is what
all
you
there
have.
Is. But that's all there ever was anyway. We think Rumi's poems are much like that. Yes?
It was brought up about the Mayan calendar.
Yes.
That's an interesting thing because a lot of people were involved in this whole coming.
A debate is raging over whether December 21st, 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar, heralds a doomsday of apocalyptic proportions. Or the dawning of a golden age in consciousness. And there's a new documentary called Science or Superstition, the science behind the Mayan calendar. One of the experts is Alberto Villoldo, a PhD medical anthropologist who has researched the healing traditions of the Andes and the Amazon for over 20 years. Founder of the Four Winds Society, an author of more than 10 books, including Courageous Dreaming, The Four Insights, and Shaman, Healer, Sage. He's asked, what are the prophecies? They are indigenous prophecies of the Americas. You find them among the Hopi, Maya, Inca, and Apache. December 21, 2012 is an astronomical alignment that is going to be the beginning of a new era, of a new age. These prophecies are very optimistic. They're not the apocalyptic prophecies of Christianity about the end of the world. They're really the beginning of the world. According to the Maya, you're going to love this, humanity first appears on the planet on December 21st, 2012. So we're still proto-humans. We're half-cooked. Should we view it as a doomsday? If you suddenly had a billion people disappearing, that's a gigantic cataclysm. But this is really nature resettling and readjusting. What is the opportunity for individuals to break free from the nightmare of our past of violence and exploitation, to clear the state both individually and collectively? We can quantum leap into new humans. So it's really very hopeful. But of course, not everyone agrees with this gentleman. Yes?
If I may, I'd like to go back to mm-hmm. something we discussed earlier about people who are handicapped in various ways, mm-hmm. and we observe them, we have to deal with them. What came to mind is that every one of us at some time goes through what I believe it's St. John of Chrysostom calls the
dark night of the soul.
Of the soul. Mm-hmm. And it is something that if you have experienced it, and we all do in some way at some time, it's like a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it is karmic.
And we're also
put into a situation where you have to go inside. You're alone.
Mm-hmm.
You are alone.
You're desperate in a way.
And you know, I experienced the black hole. It was total darkness. It was total darkness.
But we're told that moments of great, overwhelming joy, and moments of deep despair are separation moments. We step away from our personality and we are in what you might call emptiness, but it's the emptiness of the all. And if we would realize that, there is a communion at that moment. You literally are at one with all of life. But for most of us, it takes those extremes. We can't do it in the normal course of events. Yes?
Well, it seems at the moment when it happens, there may be that feeling of being totally lost, totally alone, but whatever. But afterwards, there's a realization.
Right. We think HPB says that often the dark night of the soul that many what do you call them, ascetics have gone through are exaggerated, that they have dwelled in that rather than taking the reality of it. This is something that I have created that I am picturing or observing. Instead, they live in it. Yes?
Along that line of the dark night of the soul, you remember so many years ago, before we ever found Theosophy, we think it was the most, the lowest point that we ever sank to, and it was the result of a broken relationship. And it was the first time we think that in this life that we were so low, and we said to ourselves, wow, now I can understand why depressed people can kill themselves, because it's that bad. You know, and saying to myself at the time, I mean, I'm glad I'm as stable as I am, because that's not going to happen, but I can understand why some people would, if this were to go on for years and years, it would be, you know, so it gives us an understanding and compassion.
And that's what mercy is, compassion, to understand that what someone else is going through is beyond belief. I mean, but there have been, besides the if a man be mad, there have been many who have been through hell and have written about it. Viktor Frankl is one. We're not sure how to say his name. Eli Wiesel?
Wiesel.
There have been, and that the Italian who was in the Holocaust who also wrote. But when we go through something, if we stop taking it as something personal and see it as something that everyone experiences, we feel more at one with everyone and more compassionate. We become kinder. And that's what life wants from us, to give and to share. Yes, those difficult experiences are joyful when we take them in the right way. If we didn't have them, we would be absolutely selfish, conceited, horrible creatures. We need that softening, we really do. We've never heard of this man before. His name is Charles Swindoll. The remarkable thing is that we have the choice to create the attitude we will have for each day. We cannot change our past. We cannot change the way people act. We cannot change the inevitable. The only thing we can change is the only thing we have any control over, and that is our attitude. I'm convinced that life is 10% what actually happens to us, and 90% how we react to it. That sounds like Epictetus. The freedom of man ends with his freedom to choose. Once the choice is made, justice and mercy step in. You choose, you will get the result. Now, that's another thing you learn from here. You can mitigate karma through the power of a vow or by setting up opposite conditions, because when two equal and opposing forces meet each other, they cancel each other out. So you can create conditions that will prevent some horrible karma from being as bad as it would be. But that isn't really the reason we should do it, to escape the results. It's one of the reasons we're told not to attempt spiritual healings for physical problems, because we used our spiritual powers to create the problem. We should therefore assume the responsibility for it and do everything physical that we can. But this is, we promise you, this is the little pamphlet you want. There's two others one on karma and one on cycles, and that's what karma is, cycles, on the book table. But this one for a quarter will never fail you. Our meeting is adjourned.
Push the button.